Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Marjorie Pabst, the host of Caregiver and Physician Conversations, sponsored by eCareDiary.com. I am a speaker, facilitator, and co-author of Enrich Your Caregiving Journey, a book of caregiver stories that demonstrates practical tips for the family or professional caregiver. You can access my information at www.pivotalcrossings.com. The purpose of our show is to provide practical information and tips for both family and professional caregivers, particularly on how to have those meaningful, collaborative conversations for patient healing. And today, I am pleased to welcome Dr. David Decker, the director of the Florida Cancer Institute. We are discussing what caregivers need to do when a loved one is diagnosed with cancer. What key things does the caregiver do in those early days and months and weeks after a diagnosis? Dr. Decker is the executive director of the Florida Hospital Cancer Institute. He received his undergraduate education at Eastern Michigan University and graduated with distinction from the Wayne State University Medical School. He trained in internal medicine and medical oncology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Decker has received numerous awards and honors and has been listed in the Best Doctors in America and America's Top Physicians for the last several years. He has educated many physicians at the graduate level and has over 100 presented and published research studies. As always, we will be taking your calls. Please call us at 347-857-3399 and touch 1 when prompted. Welcome. Welcome, Dr. David Decker.
Thank you, Marjorie. It's my pleasure to be here.
You know, a diagnosis of cancer is crushing emotionally as well as physically. You've been an oncologist for over 30 years. What can you share with our listeners? You know, as a caregiver, I was paralyzed with worry, not knowing what steps I should take in those early days.
That's a very good question, Marjorie. There's probably a number of reasons why caregivers worry. One could be that they're worried about the death of their loved one. Another could be that they're worried about life alone after their loved one dies. It could be that they're concerned about the delivery of medical care during the illness and basically being a nurse or a caregiver. And they also might be concerned or worried about the interruption of their own personal life now that they become a caregiver and have to give more to someone else. There might be other reasons, but these are the ones that I think probably are the most important.
Yep.
And I'll go through each of those just a little
bit.
The first, worried about a death of a loved one. There's nothing you can do as a caregiver to prevent someone's death, but I think you can have some optimism that not all patients necessarily die of cancer. The caregiver needs to be optimistic about outcome, just like the patients need to be optimistic and have some hope. Bernie Siegel wrote a book many years ago called Love, Medicine, and Miracles, and Dr. Siegel made the point that it's never hopeless. Now, I know that might be a little out there, because there does come a time probably where it is hopeless. But he gives multiple examples in his books of patients that were told they were hopeless but then did well. I've had several of those in my practice career. I remember a lady I cared for who had ovarian cancer. Her name was Martha, and I told her basically it was hopeless and time to sign up for hospice. And it turns out that she didn't sign up for hospice. She went home, and she did well. And every Christmas, it had to have been for 4 or 5 Christmases, she would put on nice clothes, come back, and just quietly leave a Christmas card for me at the front desk at the receptionist. And I've had other patients also, so you can't take away that hope, and the caregiver needs the hope that their loved one's going to make it, just like the loved one needs the hope that we might talk about later on.
Yes.
As far as life alone, if the loved one dies, This morning, I was with a notary and I signed some documents that's my last will and testament. I'm updating my trust. I'm a healthy person, and I think about what life would be like for my wife if I don't make it, or if my wife dies and I live without her. I don't think that's an abnormal thing to think about.
And it is real life for all of us, really, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah.
When you're faced, you're living with someone that has a potentially fatal disease, it is not wrong to plan for what would happen or think about what would happen without them, even to discuss this with them. My wife and I discussed what we're going to do, and again, we're two healthy individuals. So I think you need to plan for that, and it'll take some of the worry away. The delivery of medical care can be a real challenge for some loved ones because they're not medical people.
Yeah.
But there are some things that they can do to help out. I think they can try to become medical by attending all of their loved ones' physicians' appointments. And at those appointments, maybe bringing in a sheet that they have questions on and can answer questions. And don't leave the doctor's office until your questions are answered, such as what will happen if my husband becomes incontinent at night and I don't know what to do. I think you're entitled to have those answered. Or if the doctor's uncomfortable answering, you could ask to meet with one of the nurses and maybe the nurses could answer. Caregivers need to rely on friends and family. Sometimes in a family, there is one person that's the caregiver and does more of that than the others. But the others should be called in and asked to participate. If they're uncomfortable, obviously they shouldn't, but most of them are not uncomfortable and will help. Caregiver also needs to consider the fact that they might not be capable of giving care, and it is not wrong to have your loved one in an extended care facility, because that might actually be the best thing for the loved one and also for the caregiver, even though the caregiver might view that as a failure that loved one went to an extended care facility.
That's a very interesting observation. And I think, and when you say it's a win-win for both of them, that there are alternatives to always saying, oh, I have to be the caregiver. That's not necessarily so.
Yes, and I've been through that in the past. What I've tried to do is assure the caregivers that they're not a failure, that this is the best thing for their loved ones and also for them. And then also the interruption to the caregiver's life. When you have a chronic disease and the caregiver is living with someone with a chronic disease, it's going to interrupt their life. But they need to try to maintain a normal life as much as they can. So they need to still do some of the things they did before, if that was work out or have hobbies or play cards or visit friends, and try to find others to come in and spend time with their ill loved one so that they can have kind of time away where they can do things that can't be done with their loved one. They can try to maintain as much of a normal life as possible. This also might include work, that you could continue to work and then be at home at night and obviously in the morning to give care. So they need to try to maintain a normal life if that is all possible.
Yeah. Oh, those are great, great ideas. And I love the fact that you started with hope, because it all does flow from hope and in those first few days to say, you know, this...
And as a medical oncologist, a lot of times you're the patient's cheerleader.
Yeah.
So what you do is you give hope. So whenever I would give a chemotherapy treatment to a patient, I would say something like, there's a 20% chance that this shrinks your cancer. If it shrinks your cancer, you'll feel better. As opposed to, you know, the chance of this working really isn't all that great. 80% chance it doesn't work. And it might have a lot of side effects that make you sick. That's not what patients want to hear. They want to hear the hopeful side of what might work and help them, as opposed to, well, you know, we'll do this and the odds are it won't benefit you.
Well, there's a great tip for physicians, and I hope that there are some physicians and medical professionals listening in today. You know, it's that whole glass, maybe not half full, but 20% full, and to build upon that, to use your example. Well, another question I'm thinking that many people out there might have is that, you know, for some caregivers and families, cancer's cured. Family goes back to normal. For others, cancer can be a chronic condition. These days, we know that there are many more people living with cancer in an extended way, and that patient lives for a longer period of time. What are your thoughts about caregiving for the patient when cancer becomes a longer-term chronic condition?
I think that gets to two of the last issues I talked to. One is the caregiver delivering medical care and suddenly become a medical person, and also the interruption of the caregiver's life.
Yeah.
Because now you have cancer as a chronic disease, your life is interrupted as the caregiver, plus you have to become a nurse or a physician or something to manage their problems. So it's kind of the same thing. I think the medical aspect, most caregivers are worried about doing something wrong and harming their loved ones, and they need to get reassurance from medical professionals that that's not going to happen. But they can get that during their doctor's visit when they ask questions. They get a visiting nurse to come out to the house and get those questions answered. If they're financially well-to-do, they can hire help to come out to the house, but that can be very very expensive. I mentioned earlier they can get family to come in and help, or other loved ones with the medical needs. But they might struggle with those medical need issues.
Yes.
And then also you have then with the chronic patient, you have the interruption of the caregiver's life. So suddenly they have a new life, not as the husband of a healthy patient where the two of them enjoy things they used to do together, but now it's a patient and a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow the caregiver needs to maintain their normal life, as I mentioned a minute ago, with hobbies, work, outings, time away, something that will tie them or get them away from just being a caregiver and doing things that they enjoy, so they can be energized when they go back to their role as caregiver of their loved ones.
And I loved your idea about, to seek reinforcement from medical professionals that, in fact, when they leave, they're going to be okay. To make sure, get all the answers so that that gives them positive reinforcement that I can leave this loved one. And I don't, because I think caregivers worry a lot about that. I know that I did.
Did you worry about, giving medication? So a doctor will give you a prescription and says, take this as needed.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
As needed.
That's exactly right. That's what I would worry about. Things, little ambiguities like that. And so once I got some assurance as to how to manage that prescription or who was going to be there to manage that prescription, I would felt much better.
And we create a lot of ambiguities. So when your loved one's discharged from the hospital, just simple things like getting from your bed to the car, getting from car to home if there's no stairs and they're in a wheelchair. Once they get home, reading the discharge instructions, who am I supposed to call with when if the temperature's 102, I'm supposed to call, but what if it's 101.7?
Right.
But those ambiguities really need to be spelled out, and it's not inappropriate at all for the loved one to grab the doctor by his shirt or the nurse and say, please go over this with me so I clearly understand what I'm going to do tonight at 2 o'clock in the morning if there's a problem.
Yeah, very good. That's a great recommendation. As we prepared for this interview, we both talked about the ambiguity that cancer provides or brings into our lives around, well, what's going to happen? Is it going to be a roller coaster? And you said a very interesting thing. You said, life is ambiguous. We all, that we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And that I think you said something like cancer just makes it more real, ambiguity. And I find that somehow a comforting thing to think about. And perhaps those listening to us today would find that comforting as well.
Again, I just happened to sign my last will and testament today with my wife. That's a little ambiguous to me because I don't anticipate that
exactly.
I'm going to die because I'm healthy.
Right.
But if I had prostate cancer, and I know that some men die of prostate cancer, it's no longer ambiguous. It suddenly becomes real. That's more of a real threat. As I get older, I keep on thinking I'm going to keep getting older. I'm not going to have a disease. But when I get a disease, it becomes real. Again, to personalize this, I had a cardiac catheterization about 6 months ago, and all I could think about was what happens now if I become a cripple, or cardiac cripple. Turns out that wasn't a problem, so it became ambiguous again.
Right.
But when it was real, it became a real threat to me.
Yes, that's just an example. Yeah. I've often heard you also say that sometimes doctors say one thing, and caregivers and families hear something different from what the doctor is saying. Would you explain that for our listeners? And as just a cautionary tale, perhaps, for when all of us go to see any doctor, but particularly an oncologist.
Yeah, that's a good question, Marjorie. We talked about this earlier. First of all, you should never lie to patients, and you should never lie to families. You should always tell them the truth. And there's kind of the magical word, the truth. What is the truth?
Yes.
So we'll just talk about survival here as one of the truths. When you go in to see a doctor sees you, you have pancreatic cancer, and the doctor says you have 6 months. Well, that's probably one truth, you know, that the average patient lives 6 months. But if you had four patients and three of them die at 1 month and one dies at 2 years, the average is 6 months. That means nothing to the three patients that died at 1 year or the one patient that died at 1 month or the one patient that lived 2 years.
Yeah.
So the 6 month is a truth, but it really doesn't mean a great deal.
Right.
So another truth would be that some patients do real poorly. You know, they die within a month or two, and some patients live for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And that's true of all cancers. So if you look at brain tumors as an example, those patients probably on the average for glioblastomas live 4, 5, 6 months. But there's some, maybe 15%, that live will live as long as 5 years. So the truth I used to tell to the cancer patients and their loved ones is that there are patients that are long-term survivors. And I see nothing in you that means to me you're not going to be a long-term survivor. Now I'll get into some of the things you can tell, you know, where they're not in just a minute. But generally, at that point, you can't tell.
Yeah.
So I see nothing written on you that says you're not going to be one of the long-term survivors.
Yeah.
So that is one truth. But then the other truth, sometimes I would tell the family separately, you know, I really hope your loved one does well and there are patients that survive and there's no reason why they can't survive. But, you know, probably half of them don't make it 6 months. So you need to be prepared for both the half that don't make it in 6 months, and you have to be prepared for the one that makes it. And your job is to be the cheerleader for your loved one so that they're one that makes it out 2 years.
That is fabulous recommendations. Fabulous. And you mentioned, you alluded to the fact that for those who don't make it, and I didn't know this. I had a mother and a father and a husband, all of whom had cancer, and I didn't really realize until my husband got cancer what the signs were when, you know, the person's going to die. And what does that look like, and how do we know that? I mean, hospice always seems to magically know that, and that's how I learned it, was from a hospice worker. But share with our listeners that.
At that doctors, as I mentioned a minute ago, usually quote the averages. So there's nothing magical we have about knowing when patients die. But I think for your listening audience, it's intuitively obvious when a loved one is not doing well. So doing well is you're at work, you're sleeping at home in your bed, you're dressing yourself every day, you're not losing weight, you're up and around, you're active. That's doing well. As you start not to do well, some obvious things start to happen that are intuitive. You're going to start to lose weight. You're going to start not to eat. You're going to start to spend more time in a chair or bed. You're not going to go to work. You're going to start taking more medications.
Yeah.
You're going to start to have more doctor's visits. You're going to have more hospitalizations. So you can usually see that happening. And as a very simplistic example, I used to tell patients that, let's say, we're losing 10 pounds a month that weighed 160 pounds. Say, you know, I don't know how long you're going to live, and I hope you live a long time, but I can tell you that if you keep losing 10 pounds every month, that you can't do that longer than about 6 months and expect to survive.
Yeah.
So you're going to know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then I'd also use that as something for therapy. Say, to survive, what you need to do then is stop that weight loss.
Yes.
Because if you can stop it, then all bets are off and you can survive again.
Yes. Well, this has been just great, and I know we may have some listeners out there. I know we have some questions from our social media, so I just want to check, first of all, to see if we have any listeners on the line. Please call us at 347-857-3399 and touch 1 when prompted. Is anyone on the line today? Well, if not, we've had several questions that have come in, and one is, when should I get a second opinion about my loved one?
Yeah, that's a very good question. A medical oncologist, and again, I'm a medical oncologist, deal with patients that have potentially fatal disease. And the last thing I would want to do as a medical oncologist is have my one of my patients die, and then they have their loved ones questioned whether or not I did the right thing. That is just unacceptable. The loved one, in my view, if they dies, then their circle of friends and their caregivers have to look back at that and say, you know, we did everything possible. The doctor did everything possible. We have absolutely no regrets. So my view of second opinions is that I have encouraged patients to get second opinions. I've encouraged them from the start of my relationship with them, and I usually use this as a reason that I don't want something bad to happen and then be blamed that somehow we should have done something different. And I also don't want the loved ones to live with guilt that they should have done something.
Yes,
because
exactly.
Once the loved one dies, you can't take it back.
Yes.
So if the loved one has questions to deal with their guilt also, it's important. So I strongly encourage my patients to get second opinion.
Great advice.
99 times out of 100, you heard the same thing. But sometimes you heard a good idea that you didn't think of, which was helpful. That the main problem you would have with second opinions as a physician is sometimes you heard some stupid things.
Yeah.
And then here you encourage the patient to get that opinion. They have to say, well, I wouldn't do that. You have to work through it.
Yes.
But most of the times it's
very helpful. And it gives that family the solace to know that they have looked at all the options. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is an interesting question. What are the three things an oncologist says that need more specific follow-up by the caregiver? You've alluded to, or you've mentioned a couple of these during our discussion, like the six-month thing. If someone says, well, you have 6 months to live, or you have thus and so to live, that really warrants a follow-up question, obviously.
Yeah, that's a very good...
I'll
have to reflect on that question for just a minute, but that's an excellent point, Margie. Any doctor that says how long you have to live, or they become evasive on how long you have to live, I think that deserves a follow-up. Some doctors don't like answering that question because they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They're uncomfortable because they want the patient to hear you might have an average of 3 months. But again, that's just the average. That's not what you tell the patient. That, again, isn't the truth as we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
I think a lot of things doctors do. Medications, we talked about that a minute ago. Long-range plans need to be discussed. I think when an oncologist says to you also something like, I'm going to give you a treatment that's going to help your cancer, what does that mean?
Yes.
I think they need more details like, if my loved one takes this treatment, how often does it shrink the cancer? Does it shrink the cancer 1 out of 10, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 6? And if it shrinks the cancer, how long does the shrinkage last for? Does it last for 4 months, 6 months, 1 year? And then the doctor might say, well, you're not going to have a lot of side effects from this. Well, what are the side effects that aren't a lot of side effects?
Right, exactly.
So for women, as an example, the one side effect that is unacceptable is hair loss. You'd think that there's all kinds of other horrible things, but it's usually hair loss. So the patients and loved ones need to be more specific about the benefits of the treatments, the chemotherapy that we give, and the risks of those treatments, so they kind of know what they're getting into.
Yes.
Or even what are the parameters, doctor, that you'll use to judge whether or not this treatment is working? Do you use a parameter that I feel better, I have less pain, my symptoms are improved, or do you use a parameter that my tumor is smaller on an X-ray? How will I benefit from this treatment?
Yeah. That is such great advice, because I can remember as a caregiver that I would leave the doctor's office and then those kinds of issues would start preying on my mind in the middle of the night because I hadn't asked the question that you've just described. Getting at, digging deeper, what are the benefits? What are the risks? What are the side effects? And that's what haunts. It haunted me, and I'm assuming that's probably it haunts a good many caregivers because they haven't dug deep on some of those comments. They've just gone ahead and taken the medicine or whatever. Yeah. Well, this has been an amazing discussion, and what a privilege to have spoken with you with your years of experience and your training. We couldn't have gotten better information about what you do when a loved one is diagnosed with cancer. So thanks again, Dr. David Decker. Your insights give us all a very large degree of comfort in knowing about some of the key ways to approach a cancer diagnosis. In those early days, the caregiver and family just often don't know what to do and are concerned that they will make a mistake. You've also given us some many, many important ideas about dealing with cancer long term. So thanks again. Please tune in next month on Tuesday, April 24th, when I will interview our lead physician for this show, Dr. John Guarneri. We're going to be talking about integrated medicine and what that holds in store in terms of benefits for caregivers and their families. Next week on Tuesday, April 3rd at 2 p.m., Susan Vida will be interviewing Marcia Wiener on the topic of how caregivers can prevent burnout and build resilience. So be sure to tune in for our shows every Tuesday of the month. So thank you, Dr. Decker.
Thank you for having me, Marjorie.
This is Marjorie Pabst. You can access my website for archives of this show and for my other blogs that appear on eCareDiary.com. You can access that at all of this at eCareDiary.com or on my website at www.pivotalcrossings.com. Thank you, and have a good rest of the day.